Did the ejection of a Liberal candidate in the 2008 Canadian national election over a 2002 article she wrote put a chill through journalists and politicians alike who dare to challenge the official account of 9/11? We'll hear an exclusive interview with Winnipeg-based Leslie Hughes about how she has endured the accusation of being an anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist and about the upcoming book on her experiences. Are Canadians being forced to support Israeli war crimes through their pension plan contributions? We'll hear from Ottawa-based anti-war activist and researcher Richard Saunders. And also, have the prospects for peace in the Middle East improved or faded in the wake of the recent Israeli elections? Writer, commentator, and broadcaster Stephen Lendman shares his thoughts in our last half hour. On today's program, smearing 9/11 truth and profiting from Israeli apartheid. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 31st, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca, and we can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. Egyptian President Morsi is rejecting calls from the opposition to form a national unity government and start a dialogue in the name of quelling the violence that has claimed the lives of dozens of people, including two more protesters during clashes near Tahrir Square on Wednesday. Morsi, who is touring the EU in the hope of securing support from foreign governments, said in a Wednesday press conference in Berlin that, quote, "In Egypt there is a stable government working day and night in the interests of all Egyptians," unquote, and that he would not be seeking to form a new government before the upcoming parliamentary elections. Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei, who coordinates the National Salvation Front, spoke on Wednesday of the importance of stopping the violence and tweeted, quote, "We need an immediate meeting between the President, Defense and Interior Ministers, the ruling party, the Salafis, and the National Salvation Front to take urgent steps to halt the violence and start a serious dialogue." Morsi has paid lip service to El-Baradei's call, but has ignored the conditions set down by the opposition. According to blogger and journalist Wael Eskandar, Morsi is seen by his critics as a lying president and a puppet of the Muslim Brotherhood's guidance bureau. That comes to us from RT. Israeli warplanes struck a target near the Syria-Lebanon border on Wednesday in the wake of concerns openly expressed by Israel about Syria moving weapons to its enemies in Lebanon. Syrian state television said that military command confirmed the damage to a scientific research center northwest of Damascus. Two people died and five were injured in the attack. The attack followed earlier media reports from diplomatic sources mentioning an attack against a convoy close to the Syria-Lebanon border. Israel publicly warned it would use military action to prevent chemical weapons from Syria getting into the hands of Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. Israel fears that the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria could lead to an Islamist Syria, which could reignite hostilities in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, which have been reasonably peaceful since the 1967 war. Amnon Sofran, the former head of intelligence for the Israeli Mossad agency, said that Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, quote, "wants to remove everything from Syrian soil to Lebanon," unquote. Prime Minister Netanyahu has announced his intentions to build a security fence along the armistice line separating the Golan Heights. That comes to us from The Guardian. The representative of a women's research group in Haifa is saying the Israeli government is using a contraceptive to deliberately try to reduce the birth rate among black and mostly poor immigrants to the country. Hedva Eyal and other activists pointed to the 50% drop in the birth rate among Ethiopian newcomers over the last 10 years. Eyal's group and five others pressed the Israeli Health Ministry to provide details of the use of the drug Depo-Provera. The ministry responded by requesting its gynecologists not renew prescriptions if there is any sign the client might be unfamiliar with the side effects. Depo-Provera is considered the birth control method of last resort owing to the difficulty of treating side effects. In 2009, Eyal supervised a study which revealed that 57% of the users of Depo-Provera in Israel were Ethiopian, while Ethiopians make up only 2% of the Israeli population. Israel Educational Television revealed in a report last month that medical staff at Israel-linked transit centers in Ethiopia pressured Ethiopian women to take the contraceptive or be denied entry into Israel. That comes to us from The National. French forces managed to retake the northern Malian town of Kidal, the last remaining stronghold for the Islamic rebels who control most of northern Mali. The militants are now believed to be residing in the surrounding mountains. The news comes days after the French and Malian forces retook the provincial capitals of Gao and Timbuktu. With the retaking of Kidal, the French plan to embark on the second phase of its military operation, which involves the deployment of thousands of African forces to oust the Al-Qaeda-linked rebels from their desert hiding spots. At an international meeting in Ethiopia, donors pledged $455.53 million toward the African-backed force. African leaders anticipate the budget for the operation could balloon to $950 million. That comes to us from the BBC. Leslie Hughes has worked as a broadcast and print journalist for decades. She's been a journalism instructor, human rights activist, and a sought-after speaker and commentator. She had been approached by the Liberal Party of Canada to run as their star candidate in the North Winnipeg riding of Kildonan and St. Paul. Shortly after the campaign began, an article she wrote in 2002 surfaced, and it cast in a sympathetic light arguments of foreknowledge of the terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers on September 11, 2001. The article, however, soon got conflated by media, rival politicians, and groups like B'nai B'rith and the Canadian Jewish Congress as an anti-Semitic 9/11 conspiracy theory. Under pressure from then-Liberal leader Stéphane Dion, her candidacy in the Liberal Party was terminated. Hughes has since taken legal action to restore her reputation in the community. After almost 4 years, she's finally settled her court case and has been cleared of all accusations of embracing any anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. She's now in the process of writing a book about her experience. To tell us more about her ordeal and what it says about the nature of politics and journalism in the post-9/11 era, I'm joined by the woman herself, Leslie Hughes, at her home here in Winnipeg. So thank you for joining me, Leslie Hughes.
You're most welcome, Michael. We've worked together many times.
I was just wondering, first of all, if you might want to comment a bit about how you experienced this whole ordeal, as it were. I mean, what kind of a toll has it taken on you personally and professionally?
Well, you know, there's the obvious outer impact, in which you lose the respect of certain individuals and organizations that you cherish, and you lose opportunities for income, and you see that you are no longer fit, you know, to do the kinds of things that you were trusted to do previously, and it hurts. But I think there's a deeper inner damage that is done when you suffer serious allegations like this, particularly this most, you know, odious allegation, in that your inner self kind of quivers. You think, I've been made out to be a fraud, right? Because I've presented myself as a socially progressive person, you know, deeply committed to social justice, and then suddenly I appear to be exposed to something else, and the influence is so strong behind the allegations that you know it's easy to feel defeated and incapable of fighting back. So I think that the emotional toll of constantly drawing on your best resources is pretty intense. Did that make any sense? You'll have to tell me.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, this, it all started with that article you wrote in 2002. And, I mean, the heart of it was essentially, I mean, you didn't actually come out and say that you believe anything beyond the official story. You're simply saying that you we should pay respectful attention to some of the people who are questioning the official account. But is it your sense that for some reason, while it seems okay to question, say, the official reason for going to war in Iraq, but when it comes to 9/11, there's a sensitivity there. Do you have any? What's your both in relation to your experience as a journalist and your experience with this whole situation? What is your instinct about that? That sensitivity with regard to 9/11 in particular.
Well, it the events of 9/11 were a terrible shock to people who lead their lives in a pleasant, insular way, looking after their obligations and sort of untroubled by the big picture in the world. And for many people, of course, Americans represent the most developed psyche, you know, on the planet. And in some ways, I think that's probably true. My own family was, you know, my own origins are American. And I think it's just this question of that there are things we don't want to hear. And it isn't necessary to state them as facts. Even if you ask the questions, it's deeply upsetting to some people. And I think that a lot of people don't understand the importance of actually getting two reliable facts around the 9/11 incident because they don't connect it to events that immediately followed. But it's really, really important to understand that story. Because that the 9/11 story became the platform for invasion and wars in two countries and the biggest rollback of civil rights, you know, that we could ever have imagined. So I think it's a story that if people are challenging the official story, they need to do that, and it's an important thing. The problem in my case was that my trauma started with a local blogger who imagines himself to be a citizen journalist without identifying himself. I see contradiction in terms there. But in any case, he was a person who believed that the 9/11 truth movement was an anti-Semitic movement. Now, I think there's anti-Semitics in a lot of respectable movements, you know, and they remain, I think, kind of a struggling minority without really, you know, getting a purchase on the public imagination. But this person thought the 9/11 truth movement is anti-Semitic, and therefore, if I appeared to be sympathetic or even willing to discuss it as a journalist, therefore I must be anti-Semitic. And that was the message that he sent out in his blog, which has a rather impressive reach. I'm not saying he doesn't do good work now and then. And so that was picked up by the national media, and that was picked up by the defendants in my case, who then proceeded to pressure Mr. Dion, Stéphane Dion, to drop me as a candidate. And it was done in a particularly brutal way. And I was the accusation was accepted and repeated and repeated, and all of a sudden it was over. I was so shocked, so disbelieving, I actually went home to bed for a couple of days. I could hardly speak. Then I got up and decided I would run as an independent, just to make a point.
If I'm not mistaken, you found out about this from reporters.
I did. I was filming outside the CBC building. I was filming a video for my website as a candidate when a whole crowd of my former colleagues came running out of the building as if there were some kind of fire alarm. But they were waving their microphones and their cameras and their notebooks and saying, "Oh, you know, have you seen this?" And they showed me Dion's pink slip that said, you know, he had asked me to step down, which he hadn't. But once I got this notice, I guess I had to accept that I never did hear from him, by the way. Personally, I never heard from him. And most of the liberals abandoned me immediately, like rats from a ship or sailors from rats or something. I don't know. But it was very, very, very shocking. I thought it must be a mistake because I had so many Jewish connections and because I'd been very proactive in terms of Holocaust education, you know. So anyway, that's how it all got started. And when things settled down, I decided that I didn't want to be left for dead in the middle of the road. And I went to see a lawyer. That's what happened.
And I noticed that the Liberal Party was not named. Like, he didn't take any legal action against the Liberals in spite of the, humiliation that they contributed to.
And many people thought I would and should have, but the fact remains that my lawyer's legal position was that they were reacting to a defamation. They didn't initiate the defamation. They simply had to react to it, and that it would be deemed by the courts to be possibly deemed to be a reasonable action. So that's why the Liberals were in suit.
Now, you mentioned this anonymous blogger, Blackrod, and who was very instrumental in circulating all of this information to you that went right up, you know, to across the country, and just chose this moment to reveal this information when this had been written 6 years previously. What does that say to you about the current nature of journalism when you have people who are anonymous, who can circulate, you know, as you put it, like inaccurate or conflated information, and it can take, in your case, at least a 4-year toll on your life. Well, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it seems to me now, I've practiced journalism for, I guess, I don't know, 3 decades, and I've been a very vocal critic of journalism and journalists, and I have been a strong supporter of the media reform movement. I've tried to educate people about the importance of media literacy, and actually this would have been one of my platforms as a candidate. I was hoping to introduce the idea to Canadians of a national public newspaper that would not be influenced either by government or by corporations. And it was my feeling that if we had an institution like that, that Canadians would think differently about themselves and the world within 2 years. I was, you know, convinced that that's what we need, is genuinely media that is focused on the well-being of the community. However, that obviously didn't happen. But getting back to the bloggers, it seems to me if you're going to call yourself a journalist, you need 2 things. You have to have credibility, and you have to accept accountability. And as long as nobody knows who you are or who your sources are, as far as I'm concerned, then that is not journalism. That's a rant, even if it's well written. You see what I'm saying? So I think maybe well-intentioned bloggers need to think about really how committed they are. So in spite of my history of being very critical of journalism and media, I can't say that bloggers are an improvement. I do know that Jonathan Kay of the National Post credited the Blackrod with breaking the story of the election of 2008. And certain bloggers, conservative bloggers, were arguing about, you know, who would get the credit, you know, for spreading this story. Well, help yourself. You know, if you want it, now that things have turned out, you know, now that I've been vindicated by people who are accountable, I think that the story's had a moderately happy ending. Moderately, I say.
Yes. So you're satisfied that you've been vindicated? I mean, in spite of the fact that this is...
Well, the allegations have been withdrawn. Can the other damages ever be undone? I'll never know, really, because, of course, there's always people who believe what they believe, no matter what the evidence is and, you know, what the courts or the legal agreements say. But I'm not worried about those people. The thing is that I feel if I hadn't fought back, that misery would have gone forever. It would never have been over. Now that I have fought back and the allegations have been withdrawn, then I feel I'm entitled to become myself again. But it's not something you can just sort of snap your fingers and be your old self again. It doesn't work like that. It takes a while and a lot of support and a lot of nurturing from a lot of people to return to your former confidence. It's really quite amazing. The allegations of this kind really get results. They do work. I can tell you that from my own experience. And it's not necessarily that people believe those allegations, but they don't want to upset people who do believe them. And they do not want to be associated with a person who has a black cloud over their head. And so really, whether you're guilty or not is kind of immaterial. You know, you have to be treated by a lot of people as though you were. So if you ask me if I'm satisfied, well, I'm satisfied in that the allegations have been withdrawn. And I think I've done a tiny bit to contribute to the protection of journalists who may wonder, you know, who, if they were paying attention, will have wondered whether they are at liberty to republish previously published material without being held responsible for that, you know, to have to own what other people say. The fact that you reference it does not mean that, you know, you support it, or that it's your property. So I think the next time something like this happens, if someone is, you know, a politician or a lobby group is considering an action like this against journalists, I think that they might remember my case and maybe think again.
And hence you have chosen to write this book that yes. you're coming out with.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about some of the main themes running through that book? Well, the title, first of all?
Well, the title is Hit and Run, My Brilliant Career in Canadian Politics. And, of course, the career wasn't brilliant at all. It just imploded instantly.
It got a sort of like a humorous tone to it?
Yeah, it does. It's And then, of course, there are so many things to parody. I discovered so many nasty things, but I think that, you know, a message will travel a lot further if it's told in a good-natured way than if it's told as hellfire and damnation. For example, I've discovered in the last 4.5 years that Canadians cherish certain rights and protections, and they're not aware that they can't afford to access them, that if they really need to fall back on them, they can't afford to do it. I think I told you I mortgaged my house with my children's permission because, we're talking about their future. I mortgaged my house to pay the legal expenses, or I could not have taken any action whatsoever. And, you know, I hired the biggest, scariest lawyer that I could find, who fortunately had a kind of a humanitarian heart and was, you know, very candid and supportive of me. I had a legal team of two. So if there is a chapter actually on my website, and you can maybe tell people how to get there if you like. There is a chapter called The First Lawyer, and it details my visit to the first lawyer to see about the possibilities of suing roughly 30 people, and the list included the prime minister, you know, and some of the most powerful publishers and writers and, you know, dudes in the country. And it was an interesting meeting because he essentially told me that, you know, I had a wonderful case, but I shouldn't pursue it because of the way I would be treated. You know, it was going to be worse than the experience I had before. And at one point he said to me, "Is that all you wrote?" I showed him the column. He said, "Is that it?" And I said, "That's it." And he said, "Well, look," he said, if that's anti-Semitic, I'm a pomegranate and I'm Jewish." And it, you know, really gave me a little giggle to think that he, with all his, you know, austere and severe knowledge, was able to crack a little joke about it. But in the end, I didn't hire him because he had a lot of people who were whispering in his ear, you know, that it wouldn't be good for him to do that. And so I went on to find someone else who went on to bring the case to, I think, the best resolution that it could be brought to, short of actually moving out of the house and going to court. And in court, you know, a win has little to do with justice. It has to do with the very abstruse points of law. And you could be perfectly deserving of a good result, and you wouldn't get it because of something that nobody anticipated, and I didn't want to go that far.
Yeah, I guess these legal battles can be tricky. In the book, I noticed that the 9/11 truth is one of the things that you discuss, and I guess I'm wondering if your appraisal of in the post 9/11 era. I mean, you're saying that what happened to you might have put a bit of a chill through journalists. What about politicians? I mean, I noticed that you don't see any politicians lately tabling petitions to reinvestigate 9/11 as Libby Davies did before your little ordeal. Do you get into that?
It's not just that politicians are afraid to take a brave stand for which they could be punished. You know how they say no good deed goes unpunished. It's not just that, but it's easy to take an issue like the 9/11 truth movement and demonize it. You know Tony Hall, Professor Tony Hall, a prominent sociologist and a very intellectual guy. He and I had some really interesting discussions, and I think he may have actually published on this, about the similarities between the demonization of 9/11 and the McCarthy movement in the States, the same basic strategy, you know, of taking a population, whether it was the socialists in the States or the black movement in the States and people who are persistent about getting at the facts around 9/11, the genuine facts. And they're a target for any other population, like certain political parties who want to humiliate them. And that happened in the election of 2008, even though at the time it was a rising tide and growing numbers of people had actually rejected the official explanation and were actively looking at the evidence, hoping to find out what really happened. Even though that was happening, the conservatives in that election chose to demonize those folks, and I guess I appeared to be one of them because I was willing to talk about it with respect.
Well, Leslie Hughes, I certainly look forward to seeing you getting back into the journalistic saddle again, so to speak, after this long detour. But I want to thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. I don't know if you have any last words before we part.
I'm out of words. But I'm looking forward to hearing our conversation along with everybody else.
Okay. So I've been speaking with a journalist, author, and outspoken media critic, Leslie Hughes.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partner radio stations across the country. We're also podcast at the website for the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca.
Israel has been condemned by the UN International Court of Justice and through hundreds of UN resolutions for the creation of the separation wall, as well as other violations of international and humanitarian law with regard to the treatment of the Palestinian population on occupied land. Israel's security apparatus has been aided through investments from Western countries like the United States. Apparently, Canada has also been a major contributor to this military and security infrastructure. Approximately $1.4 billion of investment from the Canadian Pension Plan alone is directed to 64 corporations which profit from this military-industrial complex in Israel. To explain a little bit more about how Canadians may be, willingly or not, complicit in supporting Israeli war crimes, I'm joined by Richard Saunders of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade, based out of Ottawa. His publication, Press for Conversion, revealed the research into those investments. So thank you for joining us, Richard Saunders.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, now, Richard, do you first of all want to explain a little bit about how what provoked you or inspired you to start researching tracing the investments into Israeli apartheid?
Okay, well, I've had a general interest in the Canada Pension Plan and did research 10 years ago now on the Canada Pension Plan investments in corporations that are war industries in general, not specifically focused on Israel at all, but just the world's largest war industries and the Canada Pension Plan investments in those, in many of those companies. So I've been looking at this field of research for about 10 years. And a couple of years ago, when Israel was bombing Lebanon in 2006, and then in 2008 and 2009 with the bombings of Gaza, I started looking again into these issues about Canada Pension Plan investments in companies that are in one way or another arming the Israeli military or supplying their police or their prison systems and that sort of thing, and found quite a few. Like you mentioned, that the Canada Pension Plan has about $1.5 billion worth of investments in corporations that are linked to these aspects of the Israeli military-industrial complex. Those are the figures for 2011. For 2012, the Canada Pension Plan changed the way they count their numbers, and they're not showing direct investments only, but they're showing direct and indirect holdings. So that means that they may be investing in a bank or some kind of fund that is itself investing in certain companies. So now if you look at the new numbers for 2012, it's over $3 billion. It's about 3.3 when you include the indirect holdings as well. But I also have looked at other pension funds as well that are investing in these same companies linked to Israel. And so the Quebec Pension Plan, which is also a mandatory scheme for Quebec citizens. Canada Pension Plan doesn't apply in Quebec, but they have their own scheme. It's the Quebec Pension Plan, and they too have lots of investments in these same companies. So they're over about $1.4 billion into these 68 companies that I investigated. Mm-hmm. But also, there's the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan, and they have about $750 million invested in these companies. And there's a few other pension plans. So I've looked at five or six of the country's largest pension plans, some of them, like the Canada Pension Plan, the Quebec Pension Plan, are mandatory. You have to invest in them. So they're forcing us to invest in these huge corporations.
There's no option to withdraw for ethical reasons or anything like that?
No. And the people that are managing the fund have paid lip service to ethics, but basically they admit quite directly that the only thing that they're interested in is maximizing profits, that they're really not excluding any companies whatsoever because of ethical issues. They are only focused on what they consider to be the, making profit, making money. That's the only thing that's driving them. They're not basing any investment practice on ethical issues.
So when we're talking about supporting the Israeli military and security apparatus, we're talking about weapons and construction and vehicles. Could you expand?
I looked at a very diverse array of corporations that have many different ways of being involved. So we're looking at companies like, for example, Lockheed Martin. Well, Lockheed Martin makes warplanes. It's a prime contractor. It's the world's largest war contractor. And it makes the F-35s. It's making them. So everybody probably knows about the F-35s. But they also make F-16 warplanes that Israel has more than 340 of these particular types of warplanes. And Lockheed Martin also makes bombs that are used by various different kinds of warplanes. They also make the M270, which fires cluster bombs that have been used by Israel, and that is, we have that kind of company. Or an Israeli company called Elbit. It makes a wide array of military hardware weapon systems, and pension funds like the Canada Pension Fund invests in Elbit. But then there's other companies like Caterpillar, for example.
That got a lot of news, I guess, last year with the pullout from one of our communities.
Right, yes. Some pension plans refuse to invest in Caterpillar because it makes, they call it construction equipment, but it could also very easily be called destruction equipment because we're talking about armored equipment, which is used to bulldoze thousands, which has been used to bulldoze thousands of homes and to destroy orchards, olive trees by the tens of thousands. So that's another example of the kind of company we're looking at. Also, there are some banks that. Israeli banks, for example, that invest, that the Canada Pension Plan invests in, that in turn invest in military companies in Israel that are supplying the Israeli military. So it's less of a direct connection. Then there's a Dutch company, for example, which makes armor for vehicles, and including for Canadian-made Strykers, which Israel has. Have some of those, and they've been used in the occupied territories. So there's a company making armor for combat vehicles, troop carrying vehicles. Then there's, for example, ITT that makes a whole bunch of different things, like bomb racks. You know, they're used to release bombs from warplanes, and it makes a night vision equipment for assault rifles that are used by the Israeli military. So yeah. What I did was I researched this material. A lot of it comes directly from the companies themselves. I searched within their websites for any reference to Israel, and then also there are a number of different campaigns around the world that are trying to promote boycotts of different companies. So a lot of the material comes from there, but I found a lot of material about these companies that hasn't been mentioned anywhere by any other boycott campaigns. So I think that I've contributed some new material that isn't available elsewhere that could be useful. And it's not useful not only for people that are wanting to campaign about the Canada Pension Plan or the Quebec Pension Plan, but people that are investors themselves that don't want to put their own money directly into these buying shares in these companies. So, and there's also another area that I found was quite interesting, where the spy companies, mass surveillance related companies. Israel seems to be on the cutting edge of companies that excel in mass surveillance of, and I'm not just talking about cameras, that are watching people, but mass surveillance of emails, of web traffic, of voice over internet and images over internet, how people are communicating. So they create software that can scan millions of emails and voice communications that happen over the internet, like or Skype, and they can listen in on. They're used by police and military and spy agencies around the world to listen in on millions of people's conversations and sift through it and sort it and organize it. So that's interesting too. And then our Canada Pension Plan and various other pension plans that I mentioned are investing in those companies.
Hmm. So are there other countries in the world where people are not they want to have a good pension plan, but they're not forced to invest in these companies? Or is there any other model we could possibly follow?
Well,
or are we in pioneering in new territory here?
Well, pioneering in some ways, in the sense of, for example, Elbit, the Israeli military company that I mentioned that produces all sorts of weapon systems. Some pension funds, for example, in Scandinavian countries, they seem to be on the lead in terms of starting to use ethical issues to screen out companies. And, for example, the Norwegian pension fund dropped Elbit Systems from its portfolio because of these ethical issues related to Israel. So Elbit makes warplane helmets. They make the fuel tanks for F-15s. They make... They do battle management systems. They have vehicles and with cameras on them. They have drones, the Hermes drone. They have laser systems for targeting. They make the tanks, the Merkava tanks. They tactical terminals. They do thermal imaging. So you can weapons sighting systems for nighttime vision. So you can fire your weapons at night. So, some pension funds have dropped Elbit, but curiously enough, when Elbit was dropped by the Norwegian pension fund, Canada picked it up. So Canada had not invested in Elbit Systems before, but it suddenly decided it would throw $3 million into buying Elbit Systems stocks.
So
we're on the leading edge of turning it around and saying, well, okay, other countries' pension funds are dropping Elbit, so hey, let's pick it up.
So we're kind of.
I don't know whether they really made it.
So it's like Canada is cashing in on the ethics of other funds.
Well, I'm being a bit facetious. I mean, I don't know whether they even knew that the Norwegian fund dropped it, but maybe they just happened to. Someone gave them a tip and said, "Hey, this Elbit weapons company is really great. They're making lots of money. Let's put some money into it."
I'm wondering, though, just like to close, are we suggesting maintaining the CPP investment board and just putting some ethical filters in there of some sort, or should we just go to the pre-investment board era when the Canada didn't invest its pensions this way?
Yeah,
what are your thoughts?
It's only been a dozen years or so that our pension money has been put into the stock market and into that whole gambling arena there. Before that, it was put into Canadian infrastructure programs and whatnot. And then there's room for corruption in that as well. What we should do and what's doable may be two different things. At this point, it's not really doable it would take an act of parliament to change it. And not only that, you have to have all the provinces on board. all the provincial governments and the federal government have to agree so to change the Canada Pension Plan mandate so that it would even just include ethical issues. So even just changing it in a minor way, you could say, not scrapping the whole thing, but just changing it to make it more ethical, even that seems almost insurmountable. So what are we faced with? At this point, I think that the best we can hope for and feel as if we're accomplishing something and not feel really dispirited and disempowered in our efforts is to just aim for trying to educate people and letting them know about what we can do and trying to push for, you know, just more and more people to be aware of these issues because, as you know, most people just aren't even aware.
I've been speaking with Richard Saunders. He is with the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade. His website is cot.ncf.ca and Press for Conversion, a disarmingly anti-war publication, can be accessed through that website. Benjamin Netanyahu emerged victorious following last week's elections. The coalition he leads, however, lost nearly a dozen seats in the Israeli parliament, and this will compromise, it is believed, his ability to form a stable coalition government. I'm joined on the line right now by Stephen Lendman, who has been a close observer of Israeli politics and an outspoken critic of Israeli policy. Stephen Lendman is going to give us his thoughts about the results of the election and what these results may mean for the future of Middle East peace. Thank you very much for joining us, Stephen Lendman.
Oh, thank you, Michael, so much. Before we get into the elections, can I give you a brief? I wish I could say it's breaking news. It's not quite breaking news, but it's close to it. It happened overnight.
By all means.
A brief comment on that, and then we can get into the elections. I think the two kind of tie together based on the government that Israel has and the one it will have when they agree on new coalition partners, extremely right-wing, extremely extremist, dare I say. Well, overnight, and I just did a very short article on this, and I sent it out. I sent it to Global Research. My title is Israel Attacks Lebanon. It sounds like Israel declared war on Lebanon, which it did not. So the title is a little dramatic, maybe over-melodramatic, but I wanted to draw attention to the fact that Israel overflies Lebanese borders all the time, often it's multiple times daily, and here they attacked an alleged convoy on the Syrian-Lebanese border. There was one report that apparently there was, this was overnight last night, over the weekend, I think it was on Saturday, there was another Israeli attack. It wasn't reported, and I picked up a site that quoted multiple Lebanese newspapers reporting this in different ways, and a little bit of a conflict. Every one of them reported one way, and one Lebanese paper the Lebanese government denied that anything took place. This story allegedly was that there were weapons and munitions coming from Syria into Lebanon. At the end of my article, very briefly, Michael, I question that. There's war raging in Syria. There's no war raging in Lebanon. Why on earth would Assad in Syria, who needs weapons and munitions, why would he be transferring these things to Lebanon? If anything makes sense, it's the other way around. Or any sources, the Lebanese government, Hezbollah, this part of the Lebanese government, or other sources, supplying Assad with weapons and munitions. So I ask questions in my article at the end. What's going on? What's Israel up to? And Netanyahu at the same time, the weekend was with his cabinet ministers, briefing them on security issues relating to Lebanon and Syria, and of course, this strike was discussed before it took place. And I would like to know what's going on. I will watch this, and any future developments, I absolutely will write about them. But it fits right in, Michael, with the elections, because there's no question the major media and Israeli media, including Haaretz, which usually puts out good reports, characterize the Israeli election as coming out. Israel shifts to the center. Well, my one-word comment on that is baloney. It did nothing of the sort. It got more hardline than ever.
one might think that, especially coming after that campaign, Pillar of Cloud, where we saw a lot of very aggressive military activity taking place during the election campaign, that by the incumbent government, and then the incumbent government losing so many seats, that that would be kind of a rejection of that party, and read it as an indication that you have to moderate your policies. But I guess you don't see it that way.
No, I really don't. Israelis vote for parties, not individuals. And there has never been a party in Israel's history since 1948 that on its own won a majority. So Israel always has coalition governments. In the past, if you go back far enough, you've seen Labor, when Labor really, to some extent, represented Labor. It gave that up years ago. They're hardline. They're neoliberal. They support the imperial policies, war-making, the rest of it. And that's what Israel's Labor Party is about. I think the only legitimate parties in Israel that represent people's rights and represent peace, not war, a tiny party called Meretz. They won 6 seats out of 120. They might as well have just stayed home and not had any seats. There are three Arab parties won seats, and in total, I believe it came to 11. Arabs and Arab parties are totally disenfranchised in Israel. Well, there's a process ongoing now to form a coalition government in Israel. This guy Lapid, his campaign was slightly populist. He's a fake. He's a
really?
Fake.
It's a new party, right?
Haaretz did a number on him. They really took him to the coals. They really said an awful lot about him that exposed what this guy is really about. It's almost like Obama in America. He promises one thing, and he breaks every single promise he made that means anything once he becomes president. And that's what this guy Lapid. He's not centrist. He's very much to the right of center.
Interesting. I noticed they mentioned that one of the things he campaigned on was removing the exemption from military service for Orthodox Jews.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a debatable issue, and whether it happens or not, who knows? It could loosen. There have been debates in the past on that. Mm-hmm. And my suggestion is that's the wrong debate. The right debate is for Israel to demilitarize so that they wouldn't have to draft men, women, or anybody else. Women! It's compulsory for women to serve in Israel's military. Kids are taught in grade school that they don't serve, but they're taken on field trips to military bases. There are military officers that teach in Israeli civilian classrooms. I remember writing about this a long time ago. I mean, it's awful. You know, in America, we have ROTC that's voluntary. I wasn't part of ROTC. It's voluntary, but military officers don't come into ordinary classrooms in U.S. colleges and universities and teach kids. They don't do that. If you take ROTC, they're special courses, ROTC courses. Only those who sign up for them get them. And I believe some Chicago high schools do this, where they have military officers come into public high schools and teach kids to get them ready. But in Israel, it's a mission to start indoctrinating kids when they're still in short pants to believe that Israel is threatened by neighbors, and the only way it can stay secure is to have a strong military, strong security, fight off all those bad Arabs. It's all propaganda, Michael. It really is vicious and it's ugly. Israel has no enemies whatsoever except the ones it invents. But Netanyahu, who'll probably stay prime minister, he takes full advantage of this.
Well, you do hear the Israelis and their defenders saying that they're the only democracy in the Middle East. Your response to that?
I will say categorically, Israel never was a democracy, and it's not now. It was marginally more a democracy many years ago when it did more for Jews, but now it isn't even a democracy for most Jews. It not only is belligerent, it's illegal, it's hardline neoliberal, and that began back in the 1980s, where literally the only thing that matters is wealth, power, privilege, and dominance, and most Israeli needs go begging. So benefits Israelis used to get years ago, they've been eroding steadily over the years. Israel has a big poverty problem, a big homelessness problem. Last summer, There was an Israeli who self-immolated himself because his pension was cut or something or other, but it was so small that it wasn't enough for him to live on. Israel treated him unjustly, and it cost him his business. He was about to end up homeless. He went out on social justice street protests, and finally he couldn't take it anymore. He thought literally he came to the bitter end, and he self-immolated during one of these protests. I forget his name, but he inspired a few others to do the same thing. But the bottom line on this is that Israel is extremely socially unjust. And it's a story that never gets reported in America, or I would say in the Western media. I don't check all the Western media, but I doubt the Western media says much, if anything, about this. But I've read reports, and I've written about them in the past, Michael, of the three most unjust Western societies, if I can lump Israel in with OECD countries, the Western ones, the three most unjust, and you can take them in any order you like, America, Britain, and Israel. And so imagine, Israel not only denies its Arab citizens all rights, they treat the great majority of Israeli Jews unjustly, and there have been social justice protests the last two summers about this.
So to sum up, Stephen Lendman, would you say that the results of the recent election, in spite of the reduction in seats for Likud, for Benjamin Netanyahu's party, that he has been emboldened to take on more aggressive military actions?
Could very well be, Michael. It's hard to predict what he will or he won't do. So far, in his he never declared war outright during his two terms as prime minister. He was prime minister back in the 1990s, and then he's been prime minister for almost the last 4 years. And the only targets he picked on were Gazans, you know, easy targets. Soft ones were, you know, pillar of cloud. And he came in after Katz left at the end of 2008, and January 2009 he became prime minister. It might have been in February 2009 that he became prime minister, and now he's reelected, and it looks like he'll get his third term as prime minister. Will he wage war in it? Well, you know, I hate to guess. He's been so blustery about Iran. But I wrote an article, The Mouth That Roars. Netanyahu, The Mouth That Roars. I mean, he could roar all he wants if he doesn't attack Iran. I would say this, as far as that goes. I don't see any possibility in the world that Israel would ever attack Iran, number one, without U.S. permission, probably without America going along as a joint partner in an attack. A surgical strike, any kind of strike. Israel has never done anything that outlandish on its own without getting express permission from Washington. Lots of little things it does. It can attack Hamas in Gaza. It can do anything he wants to Palestinians in the West Bank. But attacking another country, it needs permission, and it also needs weapons. And it gets a lot of them from America. The 2006 Lebanon War, Israel was running out of munitions, as I recall. Or maybe the ones it really wanted to use, cluster bombs or bunker buster bombs, whatever it was using back then, illegal weapons. And there were rush shipments of U.S. munitions to Israel to restock them. So Washington and Israel are partnered in all the important things that they were involved in, and not just in the region. It can go way beyond the region to countries that you wouldn't even imagine. It can be in South America. It can be in other parts of Asia, in Africa. Israel is a rogue partner of Washington, and you could call Israel an unofficial member of NATO. It's not an official NATO member, but it virtually is a NATO member because they ally with each other in all these things. Right now I'm worried about Syria, and here the article that I just finished just before we went on air and sent it out, Israel attacks Lebanon, and I'm wondering what is going on. What's going to happen from this? Are there plans for follow-up attacks? I don't see anything on Iran right now, but will Israel get more overtly involved in the Syrian war? Will Washington get more overtly involved? I don't know, but if anything dramatic happens, I absolutely will write about it.
Stephen Lendman is the writer, a commentator, and the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stephen, thank you so much for those insights.
Michael, thank you so much.
You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering stations across the country. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. Greetings to all our new listeners there. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.